I'm looking for guests, I always look for interesting people to talk to. I was offered computer scientist, philosopher, lawyer, podcast host. But you know what I found out was most interesting? He's the kind of person who's going to be a client for MSPs and IT services customers. So let's get into Brian Beckham's head and talk on this bonus episode of The Business of Tech. Are you and your clients tired of the time-consuming ticket tennis of coordinating meetings and help desk calls? Wouldn't it be better to automate this process with a tool that connects directly to ConnectWise Manage or Autotask? TimeZest offers scheduling automation that gives you complete control of your schedule and eliminates the hassle of calendar ping pong. As the only service designed specifically for MSPs, it integrates into your workflow and makes scheduling appointments easy on you and your clients. Plus, you can try TimeZest for free. Visit timezest.com/MSPradio and use the code MSPradio to get 10% off your first year of TimeZest. Brian, thanks for joining me today.
Great to be here, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
So you have such an interesting collision of worlds that I wanted to get a little bit of a sense of, because you're a computer scientist, philosopher, trial lawyer, and podcast host. Like, give me a little sense of how you're doing all that stuff and what you do for your money-making endeavors.
Yeah, so at my day job is a lawyer, and that's what I do. I run a law firm. I've run a law firm, VB Attorneys, for 20-plus years now, and I love it. I love the people that I work for. I love what I do because, unlike a lot of lawyers who get roped into representing giant insurance companies or pharmaceutical companies or corporations that hurt and maim people, I don't have to do that. I get to represent the teachers and the police officers and the firefighters and the moms and dads and the kids that have been victims of corporate misconduct. So I'm on the right side of the law, and it's great because every day I get to represent real people. When I first started out as a lawyer, by the way, I was at a huge law firm that represented Fortune 500 companies. It became apparent to me very, very quickly that that was not my cup of tea. But how did I become a lawyer? You know, in the early 90s, I went to Texas A&M. I was completely focused on basketball. I played basketball at A&M when I first got there. That was all I cared about. I was a jock. And I studied general studies, which is, you didn't have a major, but you kind of can sample different courses. And remember, this is the early 90s. The personal computing revolution had just kind of gained steam. The internet, I think at the time, was still owned by the government. I had an email address, but it didn't matter because I couldn't email anybody because nobody else had an email address. So this was like at the very beginning of kind of the second wave of computers. And so I was real interested in computers, took some computer classes. I was like, hey, I'll be a computer science major, not realizing all the math I had to take. And then as part of computer science curricula, you got to take a minor. Most people would do things like math or physics or electrical engineering. And I had sampled a couple of philosophy courses, and I asked my advisor, could I just minor in philosophy? And they said, yeah, absolutely. So I tell people, I say, at the end of 4 years of studying computers, I had spent most of my college career sitting behind a computer screen with a bunch of nerds. And I didn't want to spend my whole life sitting behind a computer screen with a bunch of nerds. So I went to law school. And 25 years later, what do? Sit behind a computer screen. So anyway, but it has been. I feel so fortunate because there was really no pre-planning to it. But like we were talking about right before we went on the air, obviously a computer science degree is very helpful nowadays. But the philosophy component is just as important, I think, because a lot of the questions that we're talking about from a technology standpoint aren't technology questions. They're ethical questions or moral questions or philosophical questions. So it's kind of a weird degree combination, but I'm really, really glad that that's what I study.
No, I appreciate the weird degree combination. It's a little known tidbit that I have my minor was in sociology, and I'm a computer science major. So it's the same kind of thing of bringing people together. Mine tended to be larger groups, so any listener would not be surprised to know that I'm into the data trend. But I wanted to talk to you because, in a way, you're almost the ideal customer for a lot of the people that listen to my show, because you run a law practice, you're deep into that field, but come with deep technology savvy as you think about this. So you're spending a lot of time thinking about the questions we're talking about right now on the show. And I wanted to get your sense of where your head is at in terms of the ethics that need to be put in place, the frameworks, the guidance to be effective with AI in your field.
Yeah. And some of your listeners may have seen the story. This was a couple of months ago, I think, where a lawyer had filed a brief in federal court and had written it with a large language model.
Yep.
And it had just made up a case. Like the case did not exist. I'm sure everybody's heard of this. And so, I mean, that's a perfect illustration of, at least right now. And by the way, I've been using large language models for about a year in my practice. Extremely effectively. It's a complete game changer for certain types of tasks. That said, you got to read the cases. I mean, like I know a lot of your audience is very technologically inclined. Large language models aren't really general intelligence the way that's normally defined. What they are is they're statistical machines that try to predict based on context and basic statistics and some differential calculus what words are going to appear next. And sometimes it's wrong. Sometimes those guesses are wrong. And so you absolutely cannot rely on it to cite things correctly. The other thing a lot of your listeners probably know about is terrible in math, which is very interesting from a technological standpoint. I mean, if you understand how the LLMs are programmed, it kind of makes sense. But for people to have a computer program that's good at English and bad at math is kind of a little bit of a kind of turns things upside down, if you know what I mean.
So when you're thinking about this, like how much, you're a guy who's coming at it with some of the skills on both sides of the field, but what do you see for your own, as an example of in law, like what do you think is going to be need to be rolled out for lawyers that don't have that technical acumen in order to be effective here? Like how much guidance are they going to need and what's that guidance look like?
It depends on who they are. And here's what I mean by that. I have this theory that there are basically two types of brains in the world. One type of brain is the brain where you come up with an idea and you, Dave, think of all the reasons that that is a fantastic idea, right? Then there's a different kind of brain where I come up with an idea and you come up, and this is how my wife thinks, this is how my law partner thinks. And they come up with all the reasons that's a terrible idea. And then I have to spend time justifying my position, which actually is it's good that my law partner and I are like that. I'm the guy that comes up with the ideas and why they're all good. He's the one that shoots holes in all my ideas. I have to justify them to him. And so that's a good mix. But the point is, from a technology standpoint, that applies too. So I'll give you just a couple examples. My law office went paperless 15 years ago. Back when we went paperless, and I hear the same thing, by the way, every single time. There's no way a lawyer can go paperless. Lawyers will always use paper. I've always used paper. The judges want paper. I mean, it's just objection after objection after objection after objection. But what ends up happening after a while is you realize all those objections are just kind of habits and patterns of thinking and doing, and there's really no underlying reason why you couldn't do something like that. We went to Slack to run our law firm 7 years ago, got this, we can't do this. What about email? We've always emailed that kind of, it's the same thing every time. What about this? What about this? What about, I remember when I bought my first iPad and showed it to my partner, he goes, this thing is a worthless piece of, you know what? That's the only computing device he uses nowadays. So the point is your audience needs to understand, I think, that when they're pitching technology, when they're pitching new ideas, there's two different types of minds that you're pitching to. If you're pitching to me, somebody who's technologically inclined, man, just come up with the coolest ideas you can come up with. And I'm probably going to jump on board most of them. If you're pitching to somebody like my law partner or my wife, they're going to ask you a bunch of very challenging questions that you need to understand how to answer. What you're going to get, I can tell you, in the professional circles, lawyers, accountants, doctors, things like that, they're by habit a little conservative in the way they like to do things, doctors in particular. And so it's hard to push professional lawyers, doctors, accountants, people like that, investment bankers. It's hard to push them into new technology because they get these systems and they get comfortable with their systems. And so you've got to overcome all these legacy habits. And that can be difficult sometimes. But frankly, if you know what you're doing and you're doing a good job, you should be able to justify why you're doing what you're doing. For example, when I changed my firm to Slack, I said, how would everybody like to cut back 95% on how many emails we get internally? Well, that's something people really can get excited about. And that's exactly what happened. But the point is you're either going to be pitching to somebody like me, who's going to jump all over whatever great technology ideas you have, or you're going to be pitching to somebody like my partner. You better be prepared to explain why you're doing what you're doing.
So what's the conversation you're having right now about the large language models and AI in your firm? Like what's that conversation look like?
The conversation looks like this. The conversation is, so we've been using large language models for about a year in my team, not in the entire law firm, because what typically happens in my business, I think it's like this in a lot of businesses, is you'll start with a small group of people, we'll beta test the product, and then we'll teach the rest of the firm. We'll either jettison it, and I, by the way, I have plenty of crappy ideas, so some of my ideas need to be jettisoned. But if it's a good idea, if it works, then we go and teach everybody else. So what are we talking about at my firm right now? So what does a professional do? And I'm talking about any professional. When you really generalize it or abstract it, what they do is they process information, basically. That's my job, is to process information a certain way. Doctor processes different information. Well, these large language models are very, very good at processing certain types of information. So I'll give you a very specific example as a lawyer. When I meet with a client or one of my staff meets with a client, we used to be sitting there with a legal pad, taking notes as fast as we can, barely pay attention to what the person's saying. Now you stick your phone down, you record it, the AI transcribes it. The AI also transcribes a list of tasks. The AI suggests tasks. That is absolutely incredible. I'll tell you another way I've used a large language model, which might be surprising to some people. So some people right now, I think, they think of these ChatGPTs and large language models as like Google on steroids. So they do basically Google searches. And you need to be broader in your way of thinking about these LLMs, because while they can be great search engines, they can do way more. So here's a specific example. There was a particular issue that keeps coming up in case after case after case after case. It's an argument that the insurance companies make that basically in every case, they blame whatever happened on my client. And I've been facing this for 20 years. Come up with a number of different arguments, a number of different ways to defeat this, but nothing that I really liked. And so I've had the ChatGPT, using a very long, detailed prompt, come up with arguments for me. And it is phenomenal how good they are. I mean, some of them are terrible, but some of them are phenomenal. And so I don't know if you want to call it creativity, but for generating ideas, for generating subject lines, for writing, for generating arguments and persuasive things, it's amazing. Now, again, it's not a search engine, so you don't want to go, please find three great closing arguments on this issue. That's not how you want to do it. What you want to do is you want to say, here's who I am, here's what I'm doing, here's what I would like you to do for me. I would like, and by the way, make it five bullet points. So this is called prompts. It's what they call it. The better your prompt, typically the better your output's going to be. So, but again, there's also areas where the LLMs are terrible. So I can use an LLM to help with some research. And by the way, a lot of the legal research companies are obviously starting to incorporate AI into their product. But I still got to read every single case. I mean, it is not trustworthy enough in that area to rely on completely. So to me, this raises an interesting philosophical question, Dave. I've been thinking about this a lot. I don't know the answer, but I'd just like to throw it out there. we're going to maybe get to a point where, because of these LLMs, because of ChatGPT and stuff like this, people don't write very well. Like, their writing skills and their thinking skills are going to atrophy a little bit, right? Well, if that's true, how are you going to be able to know whether what the output is good or bad? In other words, if you're not a good writer to begin with, or you're not a good researcher, or you don't know how to read case law, how are you going to check whether the ChatGPT answer is good or not? And so that, to me, is an interesting, it's like the supervisory question. You can't supervise people in a job unless you know what their job is, right? And if ChatGPT and the large language models impacts negatively our ability to write and think, who's going to supervise these machines? I think that's a big open question that people aren't really talking about right now.
It's a super interesting one, and I think we'll be exploring that as we get practical with it. And I want to get a little practical here, because I want to throw out a premise for you, and yeah. I want you to react to it for me. Because, you know, analysts like me, guys that are looking at it who are deep in the technology and the implementation and the application of it, are saying, okay, I can look at a field like legal, and I can say I believe that the impact will be very much to take away a lot of tedium of portions of it that are very repetitious to it. I would think of like a paralegal and say, like, a lot of the creation of basic documents, yeah, that's going to get accelerated away and they're going to get freed up. How much of that, as somebody who lives in the world, how much do you think of that premise in the same way?
I think about it exactly the same way. Exactly the same way. And, you know, there's this fear that a bunch of jobs are going to be lost as a result of AI. And I think that is absolutely true. And that is absolutely going to happen. As a matter of fact, I would predict that in the next however many years, I won't put a number on it, but it won't be that long, there will be no radiologist. I mean, there will be doctors who will supervise the AIs that read the radiology screens, but reading radiology films, AIs are already orders of magnitude better than a human being. It's the same thing, like, you, and I think you put your nail on the head, is kind of the rote work, the work that is not that fun, that doesn't take a lot of intelligence, but it's something that has to be done, and it's just kind of repetitive. We used to call it grunt work. We want those jobs to go away. Like, those jobs are bad jobs. Like, we want people to have better jobs. We want to automate those kind of crappy jobs. And so what I think is going to happen, I'll give you a good example, a very, very practical example in my field. So as a trial lawyer, I take depositions. Depositions are recorded by court reporters that literally type type in shorthand. And then there's a videographer that'll video the deposition. Don't go to court reporting school or videography school if you want to have a job in the next 10 years, because those jobs are going away. You don't have to have somebody physically typing shorthand on a computer anymore. There's actually companies now that have AI that'll transcribe the entire deposition, video the entire deposition, summarize it, put it into a nice format. So those are going away. But who I don't want this to sound the wrong way, but those aren't the best jobs to begin with. Like, there are better jobs you can do with that kind of training. And so it really is a balance between figuring out what are the tasks that the AI is best suited to, that I'm not better at and that my staff's not better at, and let's offload all of that stuff to automation. That's kind of my attitude.
So sort of last big thought I wanted to ask you about here is, and we were talking about this a little bit before we started, that the idea that those who are necessarily building the technology, the technologists themselves that are creating the AIs, are probably not the best ones to answer some of the big questions. But people that are helping businesses with their technology needs might be. So I'm going to ask, like, what are the big questions, not the answers, but the questions themselves that are unanswered, that you're spending most of your time thinking about in this space right now?
The big question, from a lawyer perspective, the big question that I'm asking is, how can I use and how can my staff use AI, large language models, to offload the stuff we don't want to do and to make ourselves more efficient in the stuff that we still do. I'll tell you one problem with the efficiencies that are created by AIs and ChatGPTs is I can produce about 10 times as much stuff. So I can send out a lot more stuff, but there's still a limit to how much I can consume. So in other words, if I could do 5 research memos a week, I'm just pulling this out of the air. That's not hard. I can read 5 research memos a week, but if all of a sudden I can produce 500 research memos a week, there's no way I can process that much. So right now what I'm seeing, and this is a big question, is the output has exploded. Like my output has exploded, but there's still a limit to the bandwidth of what I can input into my brain. I mean, this is Elon Musk's, this whole reason created Neuralink allegedly is because he wanted faster input. He wanted to be able to process information faster. So in other words, using AI, one of the great benefits of AI is being able to do things faster and more efficiently, but how fast and how efficient until you get to a point where you're not, you've got so much output that there's no input anymore. Like there's no time to digest what's being spit out. The other thing is, and this is another big question, I think, how much can you trust the confidentiality of some of these large language models? So these are all for-profit companies. ChatGPT is owned by Microsoft. Bard's owned by Google. They're all for-profit companies. They're collecting the data. The data is being used to train the AIs. Obviously, medical, law, accounting, banking, all that stuff, highly, highly confidential information we're dealing with. So kind of the security around this information, I think, is a big deal. And so I constantly think about how can I make sure that I'm using this product in such a way that I'm not producing too much stuff, number one, and number two, that the stuff I am producing remains confidential.
Well, Brian, you've given us a lot to think about. I know you do a podcast. If people are interested in learning more, what tell them about your podcast.
Yeah, it's called Lessons from Leaders with Brian Beckham. It's, you know, military generals, CEOs, New York Times bestsellers. One of the Republican candidates for president was on my podcast a couple of years ago. It's just a great group of very diverse people talking about leadership and with a focus on positive leadership. And yeah, go check it out. It's on all the different platforms, YouTube, et cetera. Lessons from Leaders.
Awesome. Brian, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Dave. Really enjoyed it, man.
The Business of Tech is written and produced by me, Dave Sobel, under ethics guidelines posted at businessof.tech. Like the content? Support the show at patreon.com/MSP Radio or buy our Why Do We Care merch at businessof.tech. If you want to reach our listeners, visit MSPRadio.com/engage.
Part of the MSP Radio Network.